Alright, so I thought I'd start with a question that comes up quite often, and that is, why is there so much time and energy still spent on debating the merits or otherwise of the Russian Revolution? And despite possibly your experiences, it's not just the left, not just Socialist Alternative that engages these debates, but the right as well. Robert Service, who is the Professor of Russian History at Oxford University, was reported to have said at the launch of his recent biography of Trotsky, one of the most popular leaders of the revolution, "If Stalin's ice pick didn't quite do its job of killing him off, I hope I've managed it." And for those of you who didn't gasp, Trotsky was assassinated in 1940 by one of Stalin's henchmen with an ice pick driven through his skull. So the concern of these hired pens is precisely the fact that the revolution was successful, and that horrifies those who have too much stake in this system. The idea that the mass of people deciding the course of history is too much for them to contemplate, so they resort to vulgar, baseless denunciations of the main protagonists and label everyone else as misguided fools. On the other hand, we celebrate the Russian Revolution for precisely the fact that it was successful. And to give Trotsky his right of reply, he wrote about revolution that in ordinary times, history is made by specialists in that line of business. Kings, ministers, bureaucrats, parliamentarians, journalists. The history of a revolution is first of all a history of the forcible entrance of the masses into the realm of rulership over their own destiny. And nowhere was this more the case than in Russia, 1917. So to set the scene, Russia at the turn of the century was economically and politically underdeveloped relative to its neighbouring Europe. It had been ruled for centuries by an autocratic regime in which the smallest voice raised in opposition was automatically repressed. Political freedoms just did not exist. In 1905, a revolution had brought the Tsarist regime to its knees, but it had managed to survive. Nevertheless, this revolution has been described as the dress rehearsal for the later one, and it did indeed provide Russian workers with invaluable political lessons that were put into practice in 1917. So one of the most crucial factors shaping the revolution was what is described as combined and uneven development. A large majority of the country still lived in peasant villages, and their farming methods were hardly affected by the development of capitalism in Russia. Yet alongside this, there was an industrial economy whose speed and development could, in the industrial cities like St. Petersburg, Moscow, Riga, rival some of the world's largest industrial economies. And in fact, in Petrograd in 1917, 68% of industrial workers worked in enterprises of 1,000 or more workers, and that at the time outranked even the average in the US and Germany, the two most industrialised economies in the world. These massive factories that pulled together thousands and thousands of workers became the organising centres of the revolution. They were absolutely central to the revolution. Well, the other driving force for the revolution was the First World War. The toll on Russia was tremendous but uneven. Millions of peasants were drawn from their villages into the bloody scourge of capitalist warfare. They suffered a lack of proper equipment, clothing, shelter and food in the horrific conditions of the trenches. In the rear, the huge state mobilisation created disastrous food shortages and a worsening of the working conditions of workers as productivity was pushed up. For those at the top, however, war profits were flourishing. And Trotsky wrote of the obscene situation, "Enormous fortunes arose out of the bloody foam. Lady-in-waiting Vibrova says that in no other season were such gowns to be seen as in the winter of 1915-16. A continual shower of gold fell from above. Society held out its hands and pockets. Aristocratic ladies spread their skirts high. All came running to grab and gobble in fear lest the blessed rain should stop, and all rejected with indignation the shameful idea of a premature peace." But among those who gained nothing but misery, hatred for the war and the people who were ordering it grew with every story of court excess, with every order to speed up production, and every mobilisation of further sacrifices at the front. So the revolution spark ignited on International Working Women's Day, the 23rd of February, when women textile workers came out on the streets demanding bread and an end to the war. By the end of the day, 90,000 workers were on strike as women marched from factory to factory demanding that other workers come and join them. The next day, 200,000 workers were on strike in Petrograd, swelling even further over the following days. The turning point came with the rebellion of the Petrograd soldiers on the 27th. That day also news arrived of the Petrograd rebellion in Moscow. Immediately crowds of workers disarmed the police stations, freed political prisoners and began to form new governing bodies, including a Soviet of workers' deputies. By March the 3rd, the Tsar, the last of a dynasty that had ruled Russia with an iron fist for 300 years, abdicated. The mood across the country was euphoric. And Ariadne Tikhova, a liberal journalist and a member of the Cadet Party, which was the party of the liberal bourgeoisie, recorded the words of a telegraph messenger. "Thank God we've gained our liberty, you and I. It seems to me as if I were born again. I seem to tread on air. My very soul seems to sing. I am a man. I am no longer a slave, but a free man." But the outcome, I think as the quote kind of hints at, proved to be contradictory. It seemed as if the whole population was reunited by the revolution. You know, this telegraph officer had said to the wife of a wealthy English businessman, "We have gained our liberty." Even the top generals had at the last minute advised the Tsar to abdicate. Everyone declared for the revolution. And May Day, which is the International Workers' Holiday, was made a public holiday across the country, there were processions everywhere. In the town housing the military general staff, it was the Cavaliers of St George, which was one of the most reactionary sections of the military, that led the procession on May Day. Trotsky described the scene as such: "The holiday of proletarian anti-militarism blended with the revolution-tinted manifestations of patriotism. The different strata of the population contributed their own quality to the holiday, but all flowed together in a whole, very loosely held together and partly false, but on the whole majestic." But this unity was only briefly obscured. Only briefly obscured the true nature of the situation, and that is what is called dual power. Two institutions vied for power. The Soviets, representing the working class and the soldiers and later the peasants, and the provisional government, representing the capitalists and landlords. It was a situation that, impacted by the war and the worsening economic crises, was unstable at best. The social classes on which they both rested had irreconcilable interests, and the conflict between these interests would be exacerbated by the crisis and drive these two centres of power apart to such an extent that only one would survive. The question from the end of February until it was decided in October was which one would survive. The provisional government, which was appointed from the parliament that had been elected under the Tsar in elections that were so restrictive that most of the representatives were those of the capitalists and landlords, in particular the Cadet Party. Trotsky notes the irony of the February Revolution. He said, "Thus, as a result of a victorious insurrection of workers and soldiers, there appeared at the helm of government a handful of the very richest landlords and industrialists. Remarkable for less than nothing, political dilettantes without a programme, and at the head of them, a prince with a strong dislike for excitement." Such a leadership for a revolution. But the workers, and soon the soldiers and peasants, had a different answer to the question of how to run society. In 1905, the workers had established Soviets, which is Russian for workers' councils. Immediately during the February days, they did so again. Soviets were the most democratic form of social organisation yet seen. Delegates were recallable at any time if those that elected them weren't happy with their decisions. They were not paid higher than the average wage of the people who voted for them. Deputies also remained in the workplaces they were elected from, which ensured that they shared... the consequences of the decisions they voted for in higher bodies. These structures relied on the support of the majority of workers, soldiers and later peasants, and rather than the economic power of a minority like the capitalist state today and the provisional government in 1917. By the end of May, there were over a dozen district and sub-district Soviets throughout Petrograd and in its surrounding areas, and a national Soviet was soon established. The main activity of the local Soviets, to give you a sense, were things like dealing with food supply, the maintenance of public order, labour disputes and social welfare. In short, actually the role of organising society in the districts that they headed. The factory committee, which were sort of smaller shop floor committees elected in the workplaces, also contributed to the organisation of the working class. For example, in the Gazan factory, which is the largest metalworks in Moscow, the committee submitted a list of demands to management that included creating a permanent space for the workers' committee and for general factory meetings, lectures and other cultural and educational activities, sick pay, maternity leave before and after birth, medicine to be distributed by the factory and annual vacation leave. So you can see that alongside the organisation of production and the economic questions, social and political questions were also of central concern. Now, I want to emphasise this point because it can seem sort of difficult today to understand the impact of a revolution. Just imagine that it seemed like even the most timeless things were up for grabs, like workplace management, state power and the existence of a massive inequality in wealth. If those things that always, you know, seem timeless are up for grabs, the questioning flows through into a flowering debate and action on the most intimate questions of people's lives. And in particular, women's oppression was challenged as maternity leave, equal pay and respectful treatment were demanded by women participants of the revolution. So on the one side, the Soviets of workers, soldiers and peasants' deputies holding in their hand the support of the entire working class and a vast majority of the army. On the other hand, grouped behind the provisional government were the privileged classes. But the real power lay in the hands of the Soviets. And the Minister for War in the provisional government, an enemy of the Soviets, admitted, Guchkov admitted, the government has no real power. The troops, the railroads, the post and telegraph are in the hands of the Soviet. The simple fact is that the provisional government exists only so long as the Soviet permits it. So that then begs the question, why did the provisional government exist? The answer lies mostly in the politics of the largest socialist parties at the time of the February Revolution, the Mensheviks and the Socialist Revolutionaries. The SRs, the Socialist Revolutionaries, were the peasant socialist party and wavered between wings that supported the capitalists and those that swung in behind the Bolsheviks. And towards the end of the year, they had effectively split into those two camps. The Mensheviks, which were the other party to emerge from the Russian Social Democrats after the split with the Bolshevik Party, thought that because Russia had not yet reached a stage of capitalism, to begin with, it was not possible to achieve socialism. Therefore, the coming revolution would be a limited revolution with the capitalist class at the head of it. Because of this, the workers needed to be mindful and not go too far in case they scared off the capitalists. So in practical terms, it meant that the Mensheviks were trying to straddle two hostile social classes who, under the influence of the war and economic trouble, were polarising rapidly. And if you just have a picture, you know what happens if you have one foot on two supports that are moving further away from each other. You're going to fall in a heap. This explains why the Soviets, the majority of whose delegates were either Menshevik or SR at the start of the revolution, propped up the doddering facade of the provisional government. It was the political program of these parties. The Soviets could have taken power peacefully if the Mensheviks and the Socialist Revolutionaries had actually wished to do so. Lenin was consistently arguing that point in the last months of the revolution. They did not. Instead, in crisis after crisis that shook the provisional government in the months between February and October, the Mensheviks and the socialist revolutionaries sided with the capitalists. And to give you just one example, the first major crisis for the provisional government came in April, barely a month after the collapse of the Tsarist regime. The Minister for Foreign Affairs, Milyukov, who was also the head of the Cadet Party, sent a note to the Allies that declaring that Russia still wished to bring the war to a decisive victory and reasserted Russia's claim to the Dardanelles and Constantinople. In other words, the provisional government had no intention of ending the war and still wished to gain colonies out of it. Thanks. The reaction in Petrograd was immediate, with mass demonstrations calling for an end to the war. In some cases, the demand for all power to the Soviets was raised. The response of the Mensheviks and the Socialist Revolutionaries was to join in coalition government with the Cadets. After April, when Lenin arrived from exile, the Bolsheviks instead argued that the workers would have to take power themselves, that the dynamic of the struggle would move inexorably to that question of state power. This is precisely what was happening. And the fact that the Bolsheviks didn't try and straddle the two parties meant that they were able to move to the left with the radicalising workers and soldiers. So during the summer, the economic situation worsened and many workers were convinced that this was a result of sabotage by factory owners, and in many cases they were right. In response, the factory committees took on more far-reaching controls of production, including checking books and accounts, insisting that management decisions be ratified by the factory committee and carrying out investigations of factory closures. One estimate suggests that by October, 74% of the industrial workforce in Petrograd had already was already working under some form of workers' control. This led to improvements in working conditions, so it's no wonder that the workers didn't want to hand back control. And only the Bolshevik Party, out of all of the socialist parties, stood for consolidating workers' control in the factories. This is one factor that explains their rising popularity. Soldiers, too, also began voting for the Bolsheviks because they were the only party opposing the war, and in particular the things like the reintroduction of disciplinary measures in the army. This rise in popularity was temporarily halted following the so-called July days, when workers and soldiers, anxious for the transfer of power to the Soviets, staged a series of armed demonstrations. The provisional government went on the attack against the Bolsheviks. Trotsky and other Bolshevik leaders were jailed, Lenin had to go into hiding, and the Bolshevik press was closed. The right used this opportunity to demand that the socialists in the provisional government support harsh measures to reinstitute old order in the front, including the reinstitution of the death penalty in the army. The Mensheviks and the socialist revolutionaries were also complicit in the suppression of the Bolsheviks. Along with the radicalisation of the working classes went the radicalisation in the opposite direction of the possessing classes. The possibility of a third way, some alternative to either the bloody suppression of the revolution or the taking of power by the Soviets, no longer existed. Neither the working class and soldiers nor the generals and capitalists would stand for it. And Guzon, the owner of the factory that I mentioned earlier, wrote in his memoirs of the preparation that the capitalists were making to take the initiative. Right, a private committee consisting of banks and insurance companies was organised. In order to give an official justification for our existence, we called ourselves the Society for the Economic Rehabilitation of Russia. Actually, we set ourselves the aim of establishing a large fund for supporting moderate bourgeois candidates to the Constituent Assembly and for combating the influence of socialists at the front. In the end, we decided to place the large funds that we collected at the disposal of General Kornilov for the purposes of organising an armed struggle against the Soviets. Here he is referring to the abortive coup in August by General Kornilov, who another general, Alexeev, described as a man with a lion's heart and the brains of a sheep. In fact, Kerensky, the head of the provisional government, had begun negotiations with Kornilov for the general to enter Petrograd, suppress the Soviets and the Bolsheviks and hand power to Kerensky, with powers to carry out the so-called pacification of the capital. It was only when Kerensky realised that the general was intent on overthrowing not just the Soviets but himself as well that he finally backed away and told everyone what Kornilov was preparing to do. And once he did that, the coup attempt turned into a total shambles as railway and telegraph workers made it impossible for Kornilov to get anywhere near Petrograd while others persuaded Kornilov's troops to actually turn against him. The total disarray of the coup attempt is eloquent testimony to the power of the working class and the ordinary soldiers in the army. The reactionaries could fume at the audacity of the Soviet. They could lament the disrespect of the lower orders, but their plans fell to pieces without the support of those they wished to dominate. Thanks. The decisive role in Petrograd's defence was played by the Bolsheviks. Sukarnov, who was a left Menshevik and no friend of the Bolsheviks, described the role of the party during the Kornilov coup. The Committee for the Struggle Against the Counter-Revolution, which was established by the Petrograd Soviet, making defence preparations, had to mobilise the worker-soldier masses. But the masses, insofar as they were organised by the Bolsheviks and followed them. Without the Bolsheviks, it could only have passed the time with appeals and idle speeches by orators who had lost their authority. With the Bolsheviks, the committee had at its disposal the full power of the organised workers and soldiers. So the defeat of Kornilov was the vindication in the eyes of the workers and soldiers of the program of the Bolsheviks. Already the Bolsheviks had won control of many, if not most, of the local Soviets and factory committees before the attempted counter-revolution. And then that sort of opened the floodgates. Then on September 5, the SR Menshevik Presidium of the Soviet in Petrograd resigned and the Bolsheviks were elected to a majority with Trotsky as chairman. The Moscow Soviet followed 5 days later, then other regional industrial centres. This then spread to the villages and to the front. And to give you some indication of the swing to the Bolsheviks, the Moscow garrison in June had voted 70% for the SRs. By October, 90% voted for the Bolsheviks. Among the militant and politically conscious workers and soldiers, Bolshevik power, Bolshevik influence was hegemonic. So those who don't support the October insurrection fail to see the importance of the swing in popular support to the Bolsheviks. And here is the central point, that the party won these majorities because they were the only mass socialist party that consistently backed the demands of workers, soldiers and peasants. As they had, since April, openly called for the transfer of power to the Soviets. And events proved them right time and time again. More and more workers agreed with their platform and joined the party or voted for them in the democratic organs. October, seen in this light, was the culmination of the march of events since February. As the tension between the provisional government and the Bolshevik-led Soviets mounted, debates and resolutions raged across the country. At the front and in the capitals, in the local cities, and even in the peasant villages, resolutions supporting a defence of the Soviets against the provisional government were passed constantly. Everywhere people were discussing what attitude to take to the seizure of power by the Soviets. On Petrograd Soviet Day, October 22nd, there were mass meetings all across Petrograd as workers and soldiers discussed and voted on their opinions about the transfer of power, and most supported the slogan of all power to the Soviets. Kerensky and the provisional government could no longer afford to cower in impotence. On October 19, he ordered the Cossacks to raid the Kaluga Soviet and arrest the leaders. On the 24th, he ordered the arrest of the Military Revolutionary Committee of Petrograd, of the Petrograd Soviet, the removal to the front of the Petrograd soldiers that were sympathetic to the Bolsheviks, and the shutting down of the Bolshevik press. Immediately, the Bolsheviks and their supporters moved into action. Workers seized control of the strategically important bridges, arrested the Duma, and began setting up checkpoints around the city. Trotsky describes a scene that's very different from the so-called coup. In the Vyborg district, which is a workers' district in Petrograd. A whole camp was created. The streets were jammed full of wagons, passenger cars and trucks. The institutions of the district were swarming with armed workers. The Soviet, the Duma, the trade unions, the factory and shop committees, everything in the district was serving the cause of the revolution. The same thing was happening throughout the whole capital. They were crowding out some and electing others, breaking the last threads of the old and strengthening the new. The human masses were crystallising along a new axis. A revolution was achieving itself. The provisional government's response to what was happening, I think, highlights their lack of support. They couldn't even find enough soldiers who were willing to defend them to counter the Bolshevik supporters. So instead, Kerensky and his ministers spent the day holed up in the Winter Palace making pie-in-the-sky decisions about what should be done. And just what did these glorious leaders of the democracy demand as their power over the revolution slipped through their fingers? They decided on establishing a cadet, who by that time everyone hated because they had supported the Kornilov coup, as a dictator with unlimited powers to crush the insurrection in St. Petersburg. As it turned out, Kerensky was forced to flee Petrograd in a car donated by the American embassy because all the trains and cars in the city were controlled by the Soviets. And I like to contrast this with the sight of the Kronstadt and Finnish sailors who had sailed an armada to Petrograd to back up the Bolsheviks. And the Neva is the main river that runs through Petrograd. Pavlov, who was a soldier from Kronstadt, recalled, "What did the Gulf of Finland around Kronstadt and Petrograd look like then?" This is conveyed by a song that was popular at the time, sung to the melody of an old folk tune. "From the island of Kronstadt towards the river Neva broad, there are many boats a-sailing, they have Bolsheviks on board." The Menshevik Martov, an old sparring partner of Lenin, summed up October. He said, "Understand, please, that before us, after all, is a victorious uprising of the proletariat. Almost the entire proletariat supports Lenin and expects its social liberation from the uprising." The All-Russian Congress of Soviets met on October 25 following the transfer of power in the name of the Military Revolutionary Committee of the Petrograd Soviet. The Bolsheviks and those close to them had a majority of the delegates. A questionnaire for delegates that was given out before the Congress shows that 505 of the 670 delegates had come with the principle of supporting the slogan, "All power to the Soviets." In other words, a majority had come supporting a transfer of power. Now they were assured of its accomplishment. So, immediately, Lenin proclaimed to the Congress. He said, "The Soviet authority will at once propose a democratic peace to all nations and immediate armistice on all fronts. It will safeguard the transfer of power without compensation of all land to the peasant committees. It will defend the soldiers' rights, introducing a complete democratisation of the army. It will establish workers' control over industry, and it will secure to all nationalities inhabiting Russia the right of self-determination." So what the provisional government, supported by the Mensheviks, had delayed for 8 months, causing tens of thousands of deaths at the front, starvation in the cities and growing hostility in the country, the Bolsheviks announced immediately. On top of that, in the first year, the decrees of the Soviet government included universal suffrage, abolishing the right of inheritance, making marriage a voluntary relationship free of state and church control. Illegitimacy was abolished as a legal concept, paid maternity leave before and after birth was enshrined in law, adultery and homosexuality were removed from the criminal code, the 8-hour day, equal pay, childcare and communal kitchens were established by law. 125,000 literary schools was set up, and factories created education commissions to put on theatre productions, poetry readings, orchestral concerts, and I could go on. And the society that we live in today, with its infinitely greater technology and the massive amount of wealth that has been created in the decades since 1917, has barely achieved such things. Our government won't even grant decent maternity leave, let alone, you know, free childcare or maternity leave before and after birth, paid for by the state. Everything in our society is determined by the profit motive today and competition. The priorities of our society today are exactly the opposite priorities of Russia following the revolution of 1917. So the reality of the Russian Revolution is that it shows us what is possible. Through the development of mass democratic structures of the Soviets and the conscious confrontation with the rule of capital, we saw then a glimpse of the potential for a radically different and better society.